Welcome to Hear Play Audio Theatre. My name is Simon Jones. The Triangle Factory Fire Project by Christopher Peeler and Scott Allen Evans. In 1911, the Triangle Waste Company was one of New York City's largest and most successful garment factories. The waste, in its name, refers to the shirt waste, an article of women's clothing we would call a blouse today. The shirt waste had grown enormously popular at the turn of the century, as it allowed women more freedom of movement and ease than the restrictive dresses and corsets that came before them. This was especially important as more and more women were entering the workforce and gaining more independence. For many historians, the fire at the Triangle Factory is seen as a pivotal moment in U.S. history, as this single event brought together several pressing social and political movements of the day. Immigrants' rights, workers' rights, women's rights, suffragism, workplace safety, and fire prevention. Using first-person descriptions from the survivors, trial testimony, historic speeches, newspaper headlines, articles, and other period ephemera, the Triangle Factory Fire Project dramatically explores the story behind that fateful day in March 1911, when, in the space of 27 minutes, 146 workers perished in a horrifying blaze. It also examines the shocking aftermath as union organizers, politicians, and a concerned and devastated public look to lay blame and hold those responsible to account. Ultimately, however, the play explores the effect of how a public disaster such as this shapes the very sense of ourselves and the world in which we live. In the first of three episodes, we begin with the garment workers' strike of 1909 and the tense landscape that existed between workers and their employers as the nascent union movement strained to gain traction. Fast forward 2 years, and we come to the day of the fire itself and the haunting moment-by-moment account of how the blaze takes hold and how the lives of so many of those who witness it are irreversibly changed. The Triangle Factory Fire Project, Episode 1.
Never editorialize. That was the first lesson my first editor taught me. "Shepard, you're 21 years old," he said. "You have no right to an opinion about anything but beer and girls." New York reporters see a whole lot of awful. Sights that knock the breath out of you and keep it. The key is not to look for too long, not to get sucked in. Look away, look at your hand, and remember who, what, where, why, when, and write it all down as quick as you can. Don't try to make sense of anything. Just spit out the facts, give it a catchy headline. That's all most people read anyway. That and the ads.
"The shirt waist is a revolution in women's clothing. Simpson Crawford's great spring fashion event of 1909.
First airplane sports.
Catholic priest talks socialism.
Best in company. Spring fashions for women.
Suffragettes rally
Russian
in park.
Russian peasants continue rampage against Jews.
Simpson Crawford
entire
washable silk waists.
200 Eastern European Jews enter New York.
Mountain Valley water is radioactive. This means that the greatest curative element known to modern science is active in this wonderful water.
Italy's topsoil crisis diabetes, ruining farming, cystitis, turning rivers into swamps. Malaria.
Mount Vesuvius erupts. Area is a vast desert.
2 million Italians immigrate to America.
Waste importations for Easter direct from
100,000 tenements crowd city. A new tower of 10 or more stories tops out every 5 days.
84-hour work week. Close quarters. Tuberculosis threaten lives of
Labor
workers.
Commission urged on President Taft.
200 shirtwaist makers strike against Frozen Brothers.
7,000 neckwear workers walk out. Demands include pay raise and an end to work in bedrooms and cellars.
A decided novelty.
150 workers from Triangle Waste Factory attend union
Triangle
meeting.
Workers locked out. Bosses vow to oppose union.
AFL President Samuel Gompers to address shirtwaist makers at Cooper Union.
"I have never declared a strike in all my life. I have done my share to prevent strikes. But there comes a time when not to strike is but to rivet the chains of slavery upon our wrists. This day, November 22nd, 1909 is the time and the opportunity. I say, friends, do not enter too hastily. But if you can't get the manufacturers to give you what you want, then strike. I ask you to stand together, to have faith in yourselves, to be true to your comrades. Let your watchword be union and progress. And until then, no surrender!
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Gompers. Our next speaker is Mrs. O.H.P. Belmont, president of the Women's Trade Union League. Mrs. Belmont?
Thank you, Ms. Schneiderman. The plight of the girls toiling in the shirtwaist factories, and indeed of all working girls, is yet another example of the effect of the disenfranchisement of women. This day is not just about these poor, oppressed girls. This day is about all women, rich, poor, and middle class, educated and illiterate, famous, infamous, and unknown. This day begs the question, what is a woman's place in the world?
Excuse me.
We must go for...
Perhaps after the scheduled speakers.
After the scheduled speakers, we'll all be asleep.
Who are you, young woman?
My name is...
Gentlemen of the jury, on March 25th, 1911, a terrible fire took the lives of 146 people. All of them dead in the space of half an hour. But we will not, we cannot present a case that will encompass the enormity of this tragedy. Instead, we will focus on one specific story, that of Margaret Schwartz.
Miss Schwartz, a union cannot be strong unless it is organized. Please continue, Mrs. Belmont.
What is a woman's place in the world? We must go... But...
All right, then.
But I haven't finished.
Please, Mrs. Belmont. Thank you so much. Miss Schwartz, you can come up.
Thank you. I have listened to you all talk for 3 hours now. I have no further patience for talk. The fact is, because a few of us women went to a meeting to hear about a union, all of us got locked out. This is not something to talk and talk and talk about. Our lives are at risk. The owners will not let us earn our living. All we have is each other. Let us pledge ourselves to the union they're so afraid of. I move that we go on a general strike.
...15,000 shirtwaist workers walk out. First strike led by women.
5,000 join shirtwaist strike.
International Ladies Garment Workers Union pickets for 20% pay raise, 52-hour week, and promise to hire only union workers.
In the black of winter of 1909, when we froze and bled on the picket line, we showed the world that women could fight, and we rose and won with women's might.
Schubert's donate a week of box office to girl strikers.
Striker accused of assaulting scab.
Mrs. Belmont offers mansion as collateral to bail out arrested striker.
70 shop owners settle in first 48 hours of shirtwaist strike.
Throng cheers on the girl strikers.
Hail the waist makers of 1909, making their stand on the picket line.
50 shirtwaist girls upset by socialist oratory carried out of Central Palace meeting. Mayor's name hissed.
Triangle Waste Company, city's largest, holds out against strikers.
From Isaac Harris and Max Blank, Triangle Waste Company. Gentlemen, you are aware of the agitation that is now going on in all our shops. Our satisfied workers are being molested and interfered with by this so-called union. In order to prevent these irresponsible anarchists from gaining the upper hand, let us know as soon as you possibly can if you would be willing to form and join an employer's mutual protection association.
Breaking the power of those who reign, pointing the way, smashing the chain.
Waste strike spreads to Jersey.
Mrs. Belmont arrested on picket line. Millionaire husband posts bail.
The Greater New York Detective Agency can furnish trained detectives to guard life and property, and if necessary, furnish help of all kinds, both male and female, for all trades.
Hey, Margaret Schwartz?
Yes?
Mr. Harris and Mr. Blank have sent us to see you home.
I don't know you. Let go of me!
Shut up!
Help!
Keep your mouth shut!
Help me! Stop! Don't!
Shut up! I'd stay down there if you know what's good for you.
Help!
Come on, she's had enough.
Someone, please! Help me!
Gomper says police in league with shop
owners. Strikers sent to Rikers.
Manufacturer's lawyer calls women's suffrage an imaginary cause.
And we gave new courage to the men who carried on in 1910.
Shirtwaist strike ends.
Triangle Factory allows workers to return with shorter hours, slight raise, refuses all other union demands.
Shoulder to shoulder, we'll win through, led by the ILGWU.
Every day I see someone on the worst day of his life. I've seen husbands kiss the bloodied lips of lifeless wives, heard wives whisper into the deaf ears of husbands as if they were napping and a tender word would wake them up. I've watched stunned mothers cuddle babies veiled in the blue-gray shadow of death. We've all been taught that every human body will one day stop functioning, but the reality of death makes us all children. We've been told, but we cannot understand. And like children, the survivors scream and cry and cling. But I have a job to do, so I calm them down the only way I can, by letting them tell their story.
It was Saturday, March 25th, 1911. A clear, cold, windy day. The Triangle Factory was on the 8th, 9th, and 10th floors of the Ash Building at the corner of Washington Place and Green Street. My sister, Margaret, I'm Max, Max Schwartz. Margaret and I hurried so we wouldn't be late to work.
On that Thursday, we had celebrated my engagement to David. He is a boy my aunt introduced me to. A wonderful dancer. So we had the party, the whole family, dancing and singing, and we stayed up too late. My brother Max and I skipped work on Friday, the first day I'd ever missed. On Saturday, Mr. Bernstein was waiting for us.
Samuel Bernstein. I told them their places on the 8th floor had been taken. If they wanted to work, they would have to go to the 9th floor.
That's how we came to be on the 9th floor that day. I was mad because it was so loud up there with all the machines. Maybe if my sister hadn't been engaged, she would be alive.
It was 2 days before my 18th birthday. I had been working at the Triangle Shirtwaist Company for 2 years. It was across the street from where I lived, and they paid me $9 a week. The first day I came, I said I didn't know anything about sewing, but they said, "That's all right, Rose." They had a machine for me, a Julian special. All I had to do was put a button in, and it goes through the waist. That day, we were almost ready to leave.
I was on the 8th floor. I was the superintendent and manager. Mr. Blank is a brother-in-law of mine, and Mr. Harris's wife is a cousin of mine. I had been with them for 12 years. My brother Jacob Bernstein worked on the 9th floor. My cousin Louis Alter was in charge of the 10th, and another Bernstein, William...
No relation.
...worked on the 8th.
I was a cutter. There were 20 of us and maybe 200 machine operators on the 8th. But we were all men, and we worked with big knives, so most of the girls were scared of us.
I was standing near a desk of another cousin of mine by the name of Dinah Lifshitz.
I was a bookkeeper, so I was in charge of the accounts of the operators. There was a new girl who'd been working for about 2 days. I called Mr. Bernstein over to make a price for that girl.
She asked me what she was going to get, and I made the price with her of $14, and she was perfectly satisfied. And then she walked away from me, and the bell rang to stop the machines.
On the 9th floor where I was were the finishers, mostly women, Jewish women, and the sewing machines, about 250 of them at 8 long tables. There were old-timers and there were healthy girls. There were girls like me who had been here a few years and called themselves Americans. And there were European immigrants, new off the boat, like my friend Yetta.
I had been an operator on the ninth floor for 7 weeks. I put aside a few dollars each week to bring my sister over from Russia. This girl, Kate Alterman, was teaching me new dance steps.
I was working as lace cutter for 9 months. My mother didn't want me to work, but my friend Margaret says, come on, we have good time. Lots of young Jewish girls was there, mostly engaged. We used to have a lot of fun.
I was a beltboy. On the ninth floor, all the machines on the 75-foot tables were connected by belts so they could all be run by one engine. When a belt broke, I went under the table and replaced it. I had started as a button puncher, but I saved up $12 and bought the head machinist a watch fob. He said, Abe, I'm gonna make you a belt boy. And I said, thank you, sir. But what I was really thinking was, soon I'll have your job.
I was a floor girl on the ninth floor. I ran pieces of wastes from one station to the next, but I had my own desk, too, right next to the time clock. Every day, I would watch the clock and race to be the first to the door. Everybody would say, look out for Ethel! You had to be quick, or else you'd get stuck in line. We all had to wait while the watchman at the Green Street door searched our purses. The door was about 20 feet in front of me and to the left, but the dressing room was on the Washington Place side behind me. I sang myself a little song of what to do when the bell rang. Up, turn, step, 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 coat, hat, run! Saturday was a short day, so the bell rang at 4:45. While the machines were still turning off, I grabbed my pocketbook and hurried to the dressing room to get my coat, my hat, and my new fur muff. I had saved for weeks to buy that muff.
On the 10th floor were the executives.
Mr. Harris was in his office with a salesman, and Mr. Blank was getting ready to leave with his two kids. He was going to take them shopping. He just called in to me, Mary, get me a taxi. And I had. I was typing bills like usual, but I was also working the switchboard. Edna, the regular girl, was out sick, and my Uncle Louie, who was the supervisor of the 10th floor, asked me to do two jobs at once, which was harder because Eddie Markowitz, the shipping clerk, kept hovering over me.
I was the head shipping clerk. The shipping, packaging, and pressing departments were on the 10th floor, along with the showroom and Mr. Harris's and Mr. Blank's offices. There were about 60 people on the 10th floor that day. I was entering some figures in my order book, trying to finish so maybe I could go help out Mary. Frankly, she looked a little overwhelmed.
We were getting ready to go home. The assistants were setting up the cutting tables for Monday, laying out layers of fabric with the tissue paper that separated it, then hanging the patterns on a line that ran through the loft. Some cutters could cut through 180 ply of fabric and tissue. I had it down, though. For the biggest output and the cleanest cut, it was 146 layers, no more, no less. At 4:45, the bell rang. I was there with six or seven other cutters when somebody hollered out, fire! Near the Green Street window, there were a few pails of water.
Mr. Harris's sister, I seen her running toward me and hollering, fire! There's a fire, Mr. Bernstein! At the cutting table closest to the Green Street windows, there was a big blaze and some smoke.
And I grabbed one of the pails of water, and I spilled it on the fire, and I couldn't make it go out because the rags on the table caught fire.
I saw the smoke and the blaze at about the second window from the left on the Green Street side, near the freight elevator. I cried out for the pails of water, and just then, Frank, an elevator boy, had just come up and handed me some water. In the meantime, the elevator door was open. It was very windy that day, and it blew right through awfully. It was impossible for me to put the fire out.
When the bell rang for quitting time, I grabbed my coat from the peg and I ran down the stairs. When I passed the 8th floor, I smelled the smoke, but I kept running down until I got outside. Then I remembered. Margaret was on the 9th floor.
I was meeting David after work, so I went to the dressing room to wash up and fix my hair.
I got my paycheck and went to the dressing room for my coat and hat. I was standing there talking to some girls when I heard a noise like a big...
So then I seen this girl shouting. You know, she was a very jolly girl. She used to like very much to fool us, often saying, here comes the boss, here comes the floor lady, and there was nothing. When I turned my face and I saw she is the one, why, then I didn't pay any attention to her. Just ran out of the dressing room to punch my time card.
We had this new machine called a telewatograph. I wrote with a pen connected to some wires, and whatever I wrote was supposed to also get written by the same kind of pen on the 10th floor. So I wrote fire.
I heard the signal that a teleautograph message was coming, but the pen didn't move. So I figured somebody was playing with the machine, and I went back to my typing.
I waited, but there was no answer. Then I used the telephone. I called the 10th floor.
The phone rang, but I was in the middle of typing a bill, and I didn't want to lose my place. After a while, I answered the phone, and Dinah was screaming, fire!
I told her there was a fire on the 8th floor to tell Mr. Blank.
Dinah yelled fire so loud that the girl on the other end dropped the receiver.
I put the phone down, and I went to tell Mr. Blank.
Hello? Hello? I screamed. Oh, she's gone. There's no one there.
We connected with the 10th floor if we wanted the 9th floor. When the girl on the 10th didn't answer, I said, for God's sakes, the 9th floor don't know. How can we make them know?
The fire was growing larger. It started to roar.
I saw Louis Sanderman, a cutter's assistant, and I said, Louis, get me a hose as quick as you can. He got down the hose from the 8th floor landing and handed it over to me, and I said, is it open wide? But it didn't work. No pressure, no water. I turned it one way and then the other. It don't work. I throw it away.
The line of hanging patterns caught fire and began to fall on the layers of thin goods underneath them. Light scraps of burning fabric started flying around the room. They came down on the other tables and they fell on the machines. Then the line broke and the whole string of burning patterns fell down.
A little fellow by the name of Utter. I don't know his first name. He only worked in the factory a couple of months. He was the assistant machinist. He handed me the hose from the 9th floor landing. I kept turning it, but no water came from that one either.
I went around on the partition to get more water. And when I wanted to go back, the door was blocked with people going down the stairs. So I left everything stand and went out, down the stairs with the rest.
I ran into Levine, the bookkeeper, and told him to call the fire department.
Edward Croker, chief of the New York City Fire Department. We got the first alarm at 4:45 p.m., and then 20 seconds later, more alarms and phone calls. At the first alarm, engineers in the district pumping station diverted water pressure to hydrants near the fire. And within 30 seconds, Engine Company 72 was on its way to the scene.
I found Mr. Harris and Mr. Blank outside their offices. Everyone crowded around and we rang for the elevator.
I helped Mary into the elevator. Then I remembered that I left my order book in my office. That book was very valuable to the firm. I let the elevator go.
The fire was getting bigger. On the end, right on top of the table, the lawn, the fabric was on fire. There was about 120 ply of lawn there, layers on top of layers. A boy was pulling me by the hand and hollering. I turned around and I looked at him. And the boy was burning. Then I started for the girls. They were running for their coats. I said, for God's sake, don't run for your coats. Get out of here as quick as you can. And I pulled them out. One of the girls, she said, I've got my pocketbook by my machine. I just made her go along without it. I just drove them out.
Mary never came back to the phone. I couldn't get through to the 9th floor. I couldn't get through.
And then I see how the flames were spreading, and I said, we will all get lost here. I said, Dinah, there is only one man here, and all of the girls are out of the 8th floor, and I ordered her to drop the phone.
I ran to the Washington Place door. All the girls were falling on me, and they squeezed me against the door.
I was coming from the dressing room and I smelled smoke coming from the Green Street side.
Somebody yelled fire.
All of a sudden, you've got a terrible panic.
I've seen some girls rushing to escape. I've seen women at other machines become frozen with fear. They were standing with a sort of dazed look on their faces. I tried to go through the Green Street door and there was a crowd of quick girls there and I seen I can't get out there.
I ran straight to the fire escape.
They were beginning to push toward the exit and I shouted, go nice! There is a fire. Go easy.
I went to the elevator on the Green Street side, and then I heard the elevator go down past us.
I looked down and saw the fire escape ended in a skylight. There was no way to the street.
I went to the dressing room over at the Green Street side where I started to call for Margaret. I thought I could find her, but I couldn't. So I tried to run to the Green Street door, and it was full of people and smoke.
I saw Maurice Brown, the machinist, throwing pails of water, and I said, get away from me. You can't put this fire out. And I went to the Washington Place door, where there were girls all piled up. You couldn't get it no tighter. And the door opened inwards.
I said, please, girls, let me open the door. And they kept pushing. and then Mr. Bernstein came there and pushed the girls away on one side. He opened the door, and we all ran down.
I ran back through the loft and up the Green Street stairs. I remember that I had a number of relatives upstairs, a brother, cousins. All these people were very dear to me. About 20 feet away from the door, there were cans of oil for the machines. I suppose that was burning. I don't know. The blaze was so strong on the Green Street side that I couldn't get into the ninth floor.
I came out of the dressing room. A girl examiner came right up to me and she ran to the fire escape. I followed her.
The fire escape was barely wide enough for one to go down at a time, so it filled up.
And then a whole crowd of girls ran to the window to the fire escape. But I got scared. There were too many girls. All the floors were with flames. I ran back towards the elevator. I saw a young, dark fellow at the Washington Place door. He grabbed the knob, twisted it, pulled it, pushed it. Oh, he cried, the door is locked.
I wanted to go to the dressing room for my hat, but somebody says to me, Rose, save yourself.
I came out of the dressing room. The place was full of smoke. I started choking. I couldn't stand it no more.
I went to the window and I put my face out to get some air. I calmed down. I cried fire to the people below, but some girls were pushing me. I got afraid that I would fall out. So I went back again towards the elevator.
And then I ran up to the 10th floor.
Mr. Harris was loading girls into the elevator. One of Mr. Blank's little girls, the 5-year-old, got swept into the car and started to scream and cry. He grabbed hold of her hand and pulled. He got her out of there just before the doors closed, and he held her close to him.
I saw Mr. Harris come back into the loft. You could see the flames coming in from the rear windows of the air shaft. The girls were all screaming. Let's go to the roof, he says. Get to the roof.
I had the order book in my hand when I turned and saw Mr. Blank standing there in the middle of the floor. He didn't seem to know which way to turn, so I took the smaller child and Mr. Blank held the other girl.
There was a girl there, a forelady by the name of Lucy. She fainted, and I slapped her face while she was on the floor, and I woke her up, and I carried her upstairs to the roof. I felt as strong as a bull at that time. I don't know where I got it from.
Mr. Blank was paralyzed by uncertainty, so I pulled him by the coat and said, "Come along, Mr. Blank." I saw the file cabinet start to burn as we ran through the flames to the roof.
I was walking through Washington Square when a puff of smoke issuing from the factory building caught my eye. As I ran towards the building, a policeman,
Officer James Meehan,
galloped by on his horse.
I stopped my horse outside the Washington Place entrance. I ran through the lobby and up the stairs.
I ran to a phone booth, called the office, and reported what I saw as it was happening.
I ran for the Washington Place door.
And I wanted to go to the Green Street side, but the whole door was in flames. So I went and hid myself in the toilet rooms and bent my face over the sink.
Everybody was running to the Washington Place door.
And then I ran to Washington side elevator, but there was big crowd and I couldn't pass through there. I saw Margaret, and near her was Jacob Bernstein, the miniature's brother. He was trying to open the door, but it was locked.
The door was locked.
It was locked.
The girls were climbing over the machine tables, and so was I. The aisles were narrow and were blocked by the chairs and the baskets, which were beginning to burn. So I jumped from one table to the next without getting down. I was 16 years old and I could jump. Just as I got to the door, the elevator began to go down.
8 wagons were headed for the fire. I was with the engine company 72, and we arrived 2 minutes after the first alarm. As we came on the Washington Place, I could see flames reaching out all the windows on the 8th floor. I couldn't get in the front door in the first place. The people were running out the door, panic-stricken.
On the Washington Place stairs at the 5th floor, there's a crowd of people screaming. A girl had passed out and was blocking the way. People were screaming and climbing over her, so I picked her up and got her walking down with the rest of them.
The whole shaft all around the fire escape was filled with smoke. Suddenly, a steel shutter swung out and blocked my way. I tried to push it aside, but it got stuck on the railing. It blocked the whole fire escape. People behind me started to scream and shove.
I was teaching a class at the New York University Law School when I heard fire engines. A few months before, a colleague of mine had sent a letter to the building department about the crowded conditions at the Triangle Factory, which we could see from our windows across the air shaft.
I kept running upstairs to the 8th floor.
Now I saw flames and heard ear-piercing shrieks as the girls in the factory appeared at the windows.
At first, I didn't see anyone else. Then I saw two girls at the windows, gasping and screaming. I thought they might jump. I yanked the two girls out of a window and got them to the staircase. I went back to the window to see if anyone else was there. The people in the street raised their hands and yelled for me not to jump. When I saw that, I decided it was time for me to turn around and get out. It was so black with smoke I couldn't see. So I dropped my hands and knees and crawled out the doorway and ran downstairs.
I don't know whether people broke out the windows or the flames did, but when the flames came in, we ran again in the dressing room.
I pushed some girls in there because I thought the flames would go out before they reached us.
I was crying terribly. And the same young, dark fellow said, "What's the use of crying?" I felt ashamed. And then I thought, well, my life is lost anyway. So I started to scream again.
The fire had entire possession of the 8th floor and the west side of the 9th. Flames were rising from the 8th floor windows into the 9th floor and from the 9th to the 10th. And at the 7th floor, we disconnected the house fire hose and attached our hose. At the 8th floor, we saw nothing but one mass of flame.
I kicked the shutter out of the way and walked down to the 6th floor.
I led my students to the roof, where we found two ladders that, as Providence would have it, painters had left behind.
The fire escape started to creep from the weight of all the people. Someone had broken a window, so a bunch of us went in on the 6th floor.
The Washington Place door from the stairway to the 6th floor loft was locked. We could hear screaming and pounding from inside. I turned away from the door and wedged my feet against some stairs.
I still had one foot on the fire escape when I heard a loud noise.
I pushed with all I had.
The people were falling all around me, screaming all around me.
The door frame finally splintered and some girls came running out, crying.
The fire escape collapsed.
All of a sudden, I see that the girls all started to run to the Green Street door, and I started to run too. I thought to go down, but the stairs were full of flame. I got scared.
I kept pulling at the Washington Place door, and I could not open it. So I thought I was not strong enough to open it. So I hollered, "Girls, here is a door." And they all rushed over, and they tried to open it.
Suddenly, I see the Washington Place elevator come up, and all the girls that were at the door all went towards the elevator, and I went also there.
I covered myself in cotton, and it started to burn. My hands were on fire.
I pulled and pushed the door, but it wouldn't budge. I couldn't see everyone in the smoke, so I yelled, "The door is locked and we can't open it."
The elevator started to go down. The flames was coming toward me and I was being left behind.
The 9th floor windows along Washington Place were full of people. I ordered water sprayed up to cool them off to prevent the people from jumping.
The height was 80 feet. I looked up and saw that there were scores of girls at the windows. The flames from the floor below were beating in their faces.
Then, one man jumped. When he jumped, it seemed to encourage everybody else.
I learned a new sound. It was the thud of a speeding, living body on a stone sidewalk. Thud, dead. Thud, dead. Thud, dead. Thud, dead. I call them that because the sound and the thought of death came to me each time at the same instant.
Girls in shirt waists, which were on fire, went flying out of the building so that you saw these young women burning as they flew out of the windows.
I even watched one girl falling, waving her arms, trying to keep her body upright until the very instant she struck the sidewalk. She was trying to balance herself. Then came the thud. Then, a silent, unmoving pile of clothing and twisted, broken limbs. I looked up to the 9th floor. There was a living picture in each window. Four screaming heads of girls waving their arms. "Call the firemen," they screamed. "Scores of them. Get a ladder," cried others. They were all as alive and whole and sound as were we who stood on the sidewalk. I couldn't help thinking of that.
All the windows were broken. My hair was on fire. The door was locked. The smoke was thick and black, and the fire was everywhere. I screamed and cried and started to run.
"Here they come," we yelled. "Don't jump. Stay there." One girl climbed out onto the window sash. They tried to hold her back.
Yet I jumped.
Then she dropped into space. Then came the thud. Two windows away, two girls were climbing out onto the sill. They were fighting each other and crowding for air. They fell almost together, but I heard two distinct thuds. Then the flames burst out through the windows on the floor below them.
In the dressing room, men and women were laughing, but in a strange way I could not understand at that time. I yelled at them to stop laughing and help me find a spare machine head to smash the door. I thought about jumping out, but then I saw in my mind how I would look lying there on the sidewalk, and I got ashamed. I didn't know which way to go. I was throwing people out of the way. No matter whether they were in front of me or coming from in back of me, I was pushing them down. I was only looking out for my own life. Girls were lying on the floor, fainted. People were stepping on them. Some were trying to climb over the machines. Others were running with their hair burning. My hair was smoldering. I turned and ran to the Green Street exit.
I figure I want to know what the executives are doing, and I ran through the flames and toward the 10th floor.
I was the last one to leave the 10th floor, too.
They'd saved themselves already.
The nearest rooftop was about 10 feet higher than ours, but Mr. Harris...
I don't know exactly how.
...climbed up there. He started screaming for help.
We had to extinguish the fire on the 8th floor first. The blaze was a mass of fire traveling across the floors.
The firemen began to raise a ladder. Others took out a life net, and while they were rushing to the sidewalk with it, two more girls shot down. The firemen held it under them. The bodies broke it. The grotesque simile of a dog jumping through a hoop struck me.
What good were life nets? The little ones went through life nets, pavement and all. I thought they would come down one at a time. I didn't know they would come down with arms entwined, three and even four together.
I looked up to see whether those above watched those who fell. I noticed that they did. They watched them every inch of the way down and probably heard the roaring thuds that we heard.
Mr. Harris came back with the ladder. It was too short to reach to the roof next door, so I stood at the top and pushed people up.
I saw a love affair in the midst of all the horror. A young man helped a girl to the windowsill. She put her arms about him and kissed him. Then he held her out into space, deliberately away from the building, and dropped her. She was as unresisting as if he were helping her onto a streetcar instead of into eternity. Quick as a flash, he was on the windowsill himself. His coat fluttered upward. The air filled his trouser leg. I could see that he wore tan shoes and hose. His hat remained on his head. Thud dead. Thud dead.
There were three stairs leading up to the roof with flames running over them. And here I am, 2 days before my 18th birthday. I was thinking about my mother, and I figure I got to get out of this mess. I don't cry. I don't complain. I do. I bent down, covered my face, put my clothes over my head. I can't see. The walls shook. I ran up the stairs to the roof.
We took the two ladders that we found and ran one from our building to the skylight over the Washington Place stairs, and the other from the skylight to the roof of the Ash building.
Right when I came out of the front door, a fireman pulled me away from the building. I broke from him and tried to run back in to find Margaret, but I tripped over a hose. I fell.
I heard Margaret yell, and then I pushed her on the side and I said, "Wait, I will open that door." I tried. I pulled the handle in and out always, and I couldn't open it.
I got up and I tried to run again, and this time a policeman grabbed me. I told him my sister was inside.
I pushed Kate aside, got hold of the handle, and pulled on the door with all of my strength.
And then I saw Margaret bending down on her knees.
The only thing going through my head was David, David, David,
and her hair was loose, and the trail of her dress was a little far from
her. The trail of my dress and the ends of my hair started to burn, and I fell to the ground.
She screamed, "My God, I am lost!" And then a big smoke came, and I called Margaret, but she didn't reply.
Soon I found myself standing at the edge of the elevator shaft, trying to hold myself back from falling in. I gripped the sides of the open shaft. Behind me, girls were screaming. I could feel them pushing more and more.
I tried to get to Margaret, but it was so hot, and the smoke blinded me, so I left her.
I knew that in a few seconds, I would be pushed into the shaft. I had to make a quick decision. I jumped for the center cable. I began to slide down. I remember passing the floor numbers up to 5. Then something falling hit me.
Near the Washington side windows, Bernstein, the miniature's father, was throwing around like a wild cat, chasing his head out of the window and pulling himself back. He wanted to jump, I suppose, but he was afraid. And then I saw the flames go over him. I stood in the center of the room. I just turned my coat with the fur to my face and the lining on the outside and got hold of a bunch of dresses that was lying on the examining table, not burned yet. Covered my head and tried to run through the flames to the Green Street side. The whole door was red, a curtain of fire. A young lady came in. She began to pull me in the back of my dress and she wouldn't let me go. I kicked her with my foot and I don't know what became of her. I ran out through the Green Street side door, right through the flames onto the roof.
We gave up trying to use the life nets. I led a squad up the Washington Place stairs.
The firemen raised the longest ladder. It reached only to the sixth floor. I saw the last girl jump at it and miss it. And then the faces disappeared from the window. By now, the crowd was enormous, though all this had occurred in less than 7 minutes. The start of the fire, and the thuds, and the deaths. I heard screams around the corner and hurried there. What I had seen before was not so terrible as what followed.
When I came out on the roof, there were firemen. Instead of going down to save the people, they were saving the building.
I pushed the first man up the ladder. He was a cutter. Mr. Harris and I helped the cutter up, and he was going to run away. And I said, for God's sake, stay here and give us help to push the other people up. And he stayed.
One girl's hair was on fire, so I smothered the sparks in her hair with my hands. I lifted her in my arms and tried to carry her up the ladder to the other roof. But because she was unconscious, I had to wrap long strands of her hair around my hands. Dragging her, I slowly made my way up the ladder.
One fireman, he hoisted me up to the roof of the adjacent building.
The flames were leaping across the air shaft and threatening the law library, so I sent a group of students to evacuate the books.
We pushed all the people up until there was only another man and myself, a salesman by the name of Tishner. And he was a large man, weighed 250 pounds. He was shivering like a fish, crying like a baby, wanted to jump over the side. I had some trouble with him, but I got him up. I was the last one there, and I seen the flames was coming through the roof on the Green Street and uptown side. And nobody was there to push me up, so I ran across the roof all the way to the Washington Place side where the university is.
We helped Mr. Bernstein up the ladder.
When I got to the top of the stepladder, I looked down and saw 5 or 6 girls falling from the windows.
Up in the 9th floor, girls were burning to death before our very eyes. They were jammed in the windows. No one was lucky enough to be able to jump, it seemed. But one by one, the jams broke. Down came the bodies in a shower. Burning, smoking bodies with disheveled hair trailing upward. They had fought each other to die by jumping instead of by fire. The whole sound, unharmed girls who had jumped on the other side of the building had tried to fall feet down. But these fire torches, suffering ones, fell inertly, only intent that death should come to them on the sidewalk instead of in the furnace behind them.
Then I went into the law school and walked down 10 flights of stairs. Do you think anyone walked me down the 10 flights? No. I sat on every floor. I was so weak.
Somebody had hit me with water from a pail, and so when I got to the bottom, I was cold and wet. I was sitting on the curb crying for Margaret.
The last woman to fall got snagged on a steel hook on the 6th floor. She hung there for a moment until her clothes burned, and she smashed to the ground.
We got the flames on the Green Street side of the 8th floor under control. But the heat was so intense, we had to fight our way with some difficulty up to the 9th floor. The side jamb of the door remained, as well as small pieces of the lower panels. Flames were shooting through the door. There was a pile of bodies, perhaps 9 to 10 feet from the door.
A man came over to me. He lifted my head and looked into my face. It must have been all black with the smoke from the fire. He wiped my face with a handkerchief and he said, "I thought you were my sister." He gave me his coat. I don't know who he was. I hope he found his sister.
I was looking around. I seen my father. He seen me, and he fainted. The ambulance took him away. I seen another lady I knew, and she said to me, "Rose, is this you or your shadow? I thought you were dead." I didn't even turn around when I seen what was happening.
By 5:15, 30 minutes after the first alarm, we had the fire under control.
The next thing I know, I was in a bed in St. Vincent's Hospital, and the first thing that occurred to me was that I had forgotten to take my time card out of the clock. The nun told me not to worry. She told me it was wonderful that I had enough presence of mind when I jumped to wrap something around my hands to save them from injury as I grasped the cable. But it wasn't presence of mind, it was my new fur muff. I wasn't going to lose that muff. I think the real word for my presence of mind is vanity.
On the sidewalk lay piles of broken bodies. A policeman went about with tags, which he fastened with wires to the wrists of the dead girls, numbering each with a lead pencil. I saw him fasten tag number 54 to the wrist of a girl who wore an engagement ring.
So of course I got home late, and I got a licking from my father while my mother stood in a corner respecting his anger. He kept calling me names, and I kept crying, "But Pa," but he wouldn't listen to me and told me to go to bed.
A fireman who came downstairs from the building told me that there were at least 50 bodies in the big room on the 9th floor. Another fireman told me that more girls had fallen down an air shaft in the rear of the building. The fire escape had collapsed. I went back there, into the narrow court, and saw a pile of dead girls.
I guess while I was sleeping, they found out what happened, because when I got up, they were all standing around me, smiling and kissing me.
The floods of water from the fireman's hose that ran into the gutter were actually stained red with blood. I looked upon the pile of dead bodies, and I remembered these girls were the shirtwaist makers. I remembered their great strike of last year, in which these same girls had demanded more sanitary conditions and more safety precautions in the shops. These dead bodies were the answer. Is it a man or a woman?
It's human. That's all you can tell.
End of episode 1. You've been listening to The Triangle Factory Fire Project by Christopher Peeler and Scott Allen Evans, presented by Hearplay Audio Theatre. Hearplay offers its work free of charge, but if you can make a donation of any amount, we'd be most grateful. All proceeds go to pay our talented company of artists for their time and artistry. To learn more about our work and to join us with a contribution, please visit our website, www.hearplayaudiotheatre.com. The Triangle Factory Fire Project's cast includes Jeremy Beck, Nora Chester, Francesca Di Mauro, Jeffrey C. Hawkins, Jack Koenig, Mayrin Lee, Alan Locus, Victoria Mack, John Plumpus, and Tony Roach. The original music is by Colin McGrath. This audio theatre production has been produced and engineered by Daryl Bornstein, who also created the sound design. It was produced, directed, and adapted by Scott Allen Evans. Thank you for listening and your support. I'm Simon Jones.